Hello, everyone, and welcome back to RPG R&D. I am one of your hosts, Jess Geyer. I'm one half of One of You Games, and I make tabletop role-playing games. And as always, I am here with my co-host, Craig Campbell. Hello, Craig.
Hello, Jess. I am Craig Campbell. I'm the all halves of Nerdburger Games, and I'm design and publish role playing games as well. And we have with us a returning guest, Brennan. Hello, Brennan.
Hello, I'm Brennan Taylor. I am one half of Galileo Games. So yeah,
thank you for joining us this morning. Super excited to have you back on. I'm gonna go ahead and throw it over to Craig to introduce this one, because this is actually our topic for today. Is something I don't often do as a GM. It's not within my wheelbook, oh, my wheelhouse, my wheelbook, and my playhouse.
We are wordsmiths, right, Jess? We can just make stuff up. That's fine. We're gonna start with like a GMing kind of thing, and talking about cutscenes, and narrating cutscenes in RPGs. And when I say cutscenes, I'm kind of referring to, like, if you play video games, you know, those kind of narrative driving scenes where, like, part of a story plays out that, like, wraps up the thing that you were just gaming and then kind of sets up the next thing that's going to be gaming. You as a player probably don't have a great deal of agency. It's basically just like a little movie. It's a little short film that kind of gets you to the next place. Sometimes there's some level of player agency, like you make a choice or something in the middle of that. But you're not necessarily, engaging with the game. You're just kind of getting somewhere in the story, and those types of things can happen in role-playing games. So let's talk about implementing that sort of thing at our tables.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up video games, because I love a cutscene in a video game. I'm never like, oh, I want to do this thing. Like, I kind of just let the characters do those things. But a video game is different than a role-playing game, because I'm not role-playing often as this character in a video game, with some exceptions. But I find my impulse as a player, and I know this because I recently was just on an actual play where this happened to me, and the GM was narrating essentially what was a cutscene, and I wanted to react. And I know that that is the impulse for a lot of players, that they want to react during a cutscene, but the GM at this moment wants to narrate. I'm interested in hearing what you guys have to say about marrying those two desires and urges. Again, this is not really something I do as a GM. I don't do a lot of description, long periods of time. I don't really often talk about things that are happening off camera. And Brennan, I'm also curious about why you chose this topic and what your experiences are with it.
Well, I mean, I picked it just because it sounded interesting more than anything. but yeah, I've actually done a number of games where cutscenes are an actual mechanic in the game, where the GM does. Though these games tend to be a little more narrative focused, you know, and a little more cinematic in their focus, in that you're expected to be building tension by narrating things that maybe the characters don't see. So Under the Autumn strangely does that. So with the terror.
Now, is that like narration? Is that narration like a description of a place, or is it also, does inside of the narration, does it also include action? Because
it can include action as well, you know, like something that is happening that the characters don't necessarily see. I find it's useful if you want to foreshadow things that the villain is doing in a game. I think it's useful, and especially in like a superhero style game, to be able to cut to some stuff that's going on off screen. So yeah,
jump to the villain doing muahahaha.
Yeah, exactly.
With his hench people. I've done exactly that sort of thing. That's probably one of the spots where I've used it the most, is to actually tell the the players, because you're not telling the characters, and it becomes one of those things that you might have to, as a GM, right, have to remind the players, like, okay, you're going to know about this, but your character doesn't necessarily know about this.
Right.
But it's, and like Brennan said, it's to build tension or some other emotional response in the players. There's part of gaming is like how the characters are reacting to things and how you're playing that character and their reaction. But there's also the player's experience and trying to generate a particular experience for the players. And so one of the things you can do is to like literally tell them like, oh, this is what the evil overlord is up to right now, and have it be like, oh my God, this is horrifying, or oh my God, this looks really overwhelming. How are we ever going to deal with this? And it can help to put a button on the stakes that are at play, where like maybe the players haven't quite realized how world spanning this plot is. And so you put this cutscene in there where like they get a chance to see the evil overlord is doing things that is going to affect, you know, the whole world or a very large part of the world. And it just builds the stakes, makes that like much more dramatic and much more of a driving force. And then you can always, as the GM, you can set that stuff up in a cutscene like that, to just narrate that out, to get the players on board and let them recognize what the situation is. And then also reveal some of those things from the cutscene plus other details to the characters through play later. So like now the characters are up to speed, the characters know that the stakes are really, really high too. And so, you know, like I think one of the potential pitfalls of revealing too much about what's going on with the villain or the catastrophe or whatever it is that the players are preparing for is generating player knowledge that doesn't also become character knowledge. And potentially having players making decisions based on what they know and not what the character knows. Not that that's the end of the world. You can certainly play games where the players make the decision because I'll come up with a reason for the character to be on board with this because I, as a player, want to see this happen, want to go after this thing. But if it is a sticking point for your group that the characters are informed and make informed decisions and there's a logic to everything, then you might have to kind of, you know, have that happen. And you can also build it into the game. Like you can, you know, pull up the old Palantir, like have somebody gaze into the crystal ball and see from afar and like give them that cutscene through a mechanism of the game world where the characters would actually be observing that sort of thing.
The dramatic irony of it all. Like, I love dramatic irony. I don't mind having, personally, me as a player and as a GM, I don't mind if I have knowledge that my players don't, or that my character doesn't, or that my players have knowledge that their characters don't. I don't mind that. And I think it can actually make games better in a lot of ways, because then you're kind of reacting with your knowledge of how stories work and build, rather than just putting yourself into the, like you're like as a player, then you're sort of kind of predicting what the story is going to do and making the most interesting thing happen instead of just trying to guess what the most interesting thing might be at the time. I think it can sometimes build a better story. I know some people hate to have the meta knowledge. Again, in the actual play I was just playing the last several weeks, one of the other players took off their headphones when this kind of knowledge was coming out. When there was a cutscene, they took off their headphones so they wouldn't know, so they wouldn't be informed. Whereas I and the other player listened intently so we could figure out what was going on. And there are, I know in a lot of Powered by the Apocalypse, like the GM playbooks, also include things like hint at future badness. Like those are things that I know a lot of GMs will interpret as like, okay, well, what's bad happening off screen that the characters aren't there for? I think that all those can be very effective. It's just really not a super strong suit of mine. I always want to keep the action like focused on the table, and I want the characters to interact. And then me as a player, like I said, I always have a hard time like with that boundary. I know the GM wants to like describe some stuff right now, but me, the player, I want to go do some stuff right now. And I think for me, if I had a good, clear Like, I'll figure it out eventually. Like, I'll figure it out at the first time I try to say something. The GM is like, wait, hold on. But if maybe if there's like a clear signal, even at the table, that you could decide on, like, okay, when I put this prop on my head, I am in narrator mode. Please don't interrupt me. Don't interrupt my villain monologue. Don't smash the A button to try to skip this the cutscene. Because I think that would help with players like
Yeah, the
me.
villain monologue is definitely one of the things that you know, it's a good analogy. It's because the player's instinct is to do something rather than just let it play out like it does in fiction. And so yeah, you've got to set expectations if you're going to be doing cutscenes and stuff where you know that the players aren't going to be able to affect the outcome and say, you know, this is just stuff that you know is ha that you don't even know is happening, but I want to build the dramatic irony and the tension in the game, you know. And I think that doing that with intention and talking to your players to make sure, as if you're being the GM, to make sure that they're on board with that and they're not one of the people that wants to take their headphones off, is important. Because yeah, getting everybody in the same page, I wouldn't want to ruin somebody's experience by doing it. You know what I mean? So
Yeah, I mean, that's the golden rule of everything we've said on this podcast ever is
yeah.
make sure you talk with your players, talk with the table about what you're gonna do.
Yeah.
It kind of reminds me, I talk about teaching a lot. There's a check for Matt's bingo card. It reminds me of when I do a lot. Like in my class, there are times where we raise our hand and I'll call on people. And there are times where I'm like, okay, shout out some answers to me. And then there are times where I'm up in front of the board and I am explaining things and I want you all to be quiet. And with my freshmen, especially my seniors, kind of know how to do these things because they've been in school for a longer time. But with my freshmen, I have to train them, like, here's what it looks like when I want you to do these certain things. And not that I think your players have to be trained like ninth graders, but I do think they do need to kind of like you like having those procedures, having some procedures in place can go, could go a long way. I don't do them for cutscene stuff. I don't do that specifically, but I do have procedures sort of in place for my table. Like, when do we do this? When do we do this? Yeah, I don't know. Maybe I'm also just impatient. Like my freshmen. We have a lot
Yeah,
in
and
common, me and my kids.
there are kinds of cutscenes, like especially if the players have more narrative control over the way the game goes, that or mechanics that allow players to inject themselves into those scenes to change something. Like I was using Under the Autumn Strangely as an example, there is a narrative interrupt that you can do in
Oh.
that game on another player, but only on certain ones. So there's like a GM style role called the Arcadian. There's a antagonist role called the Terror, and then there's the Traveler, who is the main character of the story, right? And the player can interrupt the Arcadian and change their narration, but they can't do that with the Terror. The Traveler can't do that with the Terror.
That's an
So,
interesting way to handle that mechanically. Like
yeah.
when you said there are narrative, like there are cutscene rules, I didn't
Yeah.
realize it got not crunchy, but I didn't realize it got that detailed. I
Yeah.
admit I have not yet read Into the Autumn Strangely. It is on my to
Yeah.
be purchased list.
Yeah, I played it twice. It's been very fun. So, yeah. I think
there are ways you can incorporate a certain level of not necessarily character involvement, but player
Player
choice
involvement, yeah.
and player choice in what you're doing. Like if you've got like the characters are off, I'm just, you know, like let's say it's like Lord of the Rings-ish and your characters are off, you know, they leave from their home and they leave behind everything that's safe and important to them and they go to these other locations. And now they're very far from home, right? And you know, there's world-shattering stakes. They've learned that, like, you know, the evil overlord is going to destroy everything. And there's attacks at their home or at these other locations that they've visited, but they're too far away to do anything themselves. You can, you know, like cut scene to your hometown. Here we are in the village, and let the players choose like what specifically they want to see. I want to see what happened at my family's home. I want to see what happened at the tavern that we all frequented, and you know, all these beloved characters that we met. I want to see what happened with the old hermit, you know, like the mysterious old hermit that lived in the woods. And so then you can kind of fill in those gaps, and that gives them, like, now, you know, in the case of this, it might be like you're giving them something to fight for. Like their loved ones have somebody's been killed, or their loved ones have been captured and enslaved or hauled off to, you know, transformed into monsters, or, you know, whatever it is that the villain is doing. And you can drive that home, and that can be player motivation, even if the characters may not find out about it for some time. You can just, well, the characters can just imagine the worst. Like,
yeah,
the characters here, like, all these terrible attacks are happening other places. They're just going to, like, the player knows, like, this specifically happened to people that our characters care about. The characters can just imagine, like, oh my God, what's happening to the people at home? We have to stop this.
And if your players are comfortable with taking on a different role for a brief amount of time, you can actually do that as a role-playing scene where the players take the roles of the people in that situation and sort of play out the scene with them taking a role that's different than their character. And that gives the players something to do in that situation. We were playing a game of adventure that all of our characters had assistants or henchmen or something. You know, everybody had a one person that was like their Alfred or whatever, you know. And we did a whole scene where it was just those characters all talking about the situation while the heroes were off doing something. So that was really fun.
That's a really fun way to handle it. I've been a player doing a cutscene like that before, and it was some of my favorite moments. And then as the GM too, you can be like, hey, okay, we're on the side characters again, same roles as before. It is a way also, I know this because my GM who did this used it as a way to help them characterize the characters, the NPCs a little bit better, because it is really hard to keep track of all these different personalities, and sometimes giving the agency over to the players can help with that. But I also really enjoy doing that as a player, again, as someone who is very impatient and wants to go do the stuff. I'm making myself sound like I'm an awful, like I'm a terrible player. I promise I do listen to my GMs when they explain. I don't interrupt them when I know that they want to talk.
I've had Jess in my games in the past, and it is she's lying. She's completely lying. She takes over the. Oh, no, I'm kidding.
yeah, I know you are. I'm a good player.
She's a good sport. She's a good player at the table.
I try to make the game fun for everyone. If you give me an NPC, I'm friends with them. If you want me to hate the NPC, sometimes I'll hate them.
Sometimes.
But mostly I'll be friends with them. yeah, I think that's a really, like, I love the idea of, like the player control of the camera in a cutscene is also very video gamey. In a lot of my favorite video games where you have these cutscenes, like where you can like change perspective of what's happening in the cutscene. Like you can move the camera around. Some of them even like will briefly give you a moment where you can say like yes or no, or ask a question. I really like that. And I think that those are all great strategies. And now I'm thinking about different ways I can steal from this secondhand knowledge of Into the Autumn Strangely to steal for future games of mine.
Nice.
I find myself often, you know, unsurprisingly, if you've been listening to the podcast, thinking of things in terms of movies and television shows, and movies in particular. And like, if you want to, I know, like every GM who runs enough fantasy, or at least a lot of GMs who run enough fantasy games, at some point wants to have the epic story. They want their Lord of the Rings, you know, like they want to have this amazing epic adventure that they're going to take their players along on this ride. And one of the things that you can do to help drive that home is because one of the hallmarks of that big epic story is that the world has a history and it's old and these things have happened and there are things that are about to happen that are happening because of things that happened in the past. There's build up to that. And so I find myself thinking about like the Lord of the Rings movies, like literally the opening sequence before the title in Fellowship of the Ring. That is a perfect opening to a campaign or opening to a chapter of a campaign cutscene of setting up the stakes of what this game is going to ultimately be about. The characters aren't going to know where this ring is. They're not going to know, like, is it, if it's even still around, or if it's possessed by somebody, or where it's located at, or if it's still, is it as powerful, you know, is it really that powerful? You know, but you could have this whole setup of telling this story of like how this ring, was forged and these other rings were forged and how this guy, like tried to take over and what had to be done in order to stop that. And you could have that whole buildup. And the same goes for like, you know, each of the opening sequences from the three movies. They wouldn't necessarily all happen at the beginning of a session. Some of them might be better at the end of a session. Like what happens with the fight with the Balrog might be better to happen after you discover the, you know, Gandalf the White, or, you know, like the character returned. Now we'll tell the story of how that happened. And here's this wonderful, this wonderful background history of what happened. And like, it reinforces how interesting this character is, and how they've changed and like how powerful they are, but yet they're still calling upon you because there are things that you can do that he cannot do and so forth. And you can borrow that sort of thing from a lot of different TV shows and movies where they set up a history or they give you a history lesson. Sometimes it's just people, it's characters telling you the history. It's like an exposition scene. Sometimes it's actually like we will flash back and show this stuff. And those can be great cutscenes that like the characters, obviously the players will know I can't interject in this. This happened 1,000 years ago. So I'm just going to enjoy the moment of understanding, oh, this is really important stuff that I'm going to need to know. And more is going to be revealed as we play.
Yes.
I'm curious about what the two of you think. Because I was thinking about some of my favorite video game cutscenes, as I am wont to do. There is a very famous cutscene in Final Fantasy VII, in which one of the main characters is killed by the bad guy. Spoilers, but everyone knows Final Fantasy VII. One of the main characters, Aerith, is killed by Sephiroth, and you cannot do anything about it. It happens in a cutscene. And I'm curious about what the two of you think about making these big plot decisions in a cutscene with no player agency from the characters, and when that might be a good idea or when it might be a bad idea. For example, again, killing off major NPCs, doing things that would normally be resolved within mechanics of the game.
Okay, so you answered my question. First of all, this is a main character, but an NPC.
Yes, it's an important character. Aerith was a
for the purposes of the game, you're not. Are you
not suggesting killing off a PC in a narrative cutscene?
I think absolutely you can't do that unless you and the other player are like, oh, I want to play a new character.
That's exactly where I was going to go. Yeah, is like, what happens?
That would
if the
be the only
like,
way to do that. I agree. Yeah.
Like, yeah, I want to play this. I want to play this other character. I think it would be great if my character went out in a blaze of glory. You know, and then you discuss that, and then maybe even give that, you know, discuss it beforehand and the player gets to describe how the character goes out in a blaze of glory. And so everybody is like, okay, I don't have an issue with the idea of, you know, again, of course, you know, having a player group that you all know each other and trust each other. And like you've talked about these sorts of things might happen, or at least they expect you to do some things like that. If you're using cutscenes, like killing off an important NPC, I have no problem with it. I don't see why it would be.
I kind of don't either. Yeah, I feel like
a big problem. It would certainly create a great deal of dramatic. You know, it would boost the drama of like.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. And then raises the stakes. So you know. Yeah.
And even more so if it's an NPC that became an NPC because they were a throwaway NPC and your players latched onto them and decided that that was going to be a major NPC. Because we've talked about that before, too. There are the important NPCs that you decide are going to be important. And then there are the ones that the players decide they really love that goblin bartender because he's funny. And now we're going to have him be horribly murdered so that you can have vengeance as part of your storyline.
Yeah. Oh, gosh. This has happened to me before. This has happened to me recently. I love the little guys. As a GM, too, I love the little guys. I love little guys of all genders, to be honest. It doesn't matter. I like the strategy a lot. Like I said, it's not really like my style of GMing. I do narration and stuff like that, and occasionally I'll do like a flashback, flash forward, little stuff like that. But I know I've played with a lot of GMs now that do a lot more narration, do a lot more cutscening. Than I'm particularly used to. Like, I'm particularly used to GMing. I have some good new strategies maybe to try out in my next game.
I would be careful of doing that too often.
Yeah.
Because
the opposite of its impact.
It loses its punch, and it also run the risk of the players starting to not care about any NPCs.
Because they know they might die.
Because he's just, right. The GM's just going to kill every NPC that we care about. But if you do it one time and have it have an impact and have it like have and not have it be a throwaway, like have it make sure that it's an impact and it has something, there's lasting repercussions and the players get to do something in response to it. They get to have vengeance or they get to deliver the news to the beloveds, their beloved NPCs, family or friends or something. They get to have a dramatic moment out of it. They get to have something that kind of reinforces what it is you're telling in the story. And then if your game world has an afterlife,
maybe there's a quest into the afterlife.
There's a question to the afterlife, or at the end of it all, you do the cutscene of like, and then, many, many years pass, the decades flow by, the sun goes up, the sun comes up, the sun goes down, the winters come and go, and in time your character passes away and you find yourself in the fields walking across, in peace and harmony, and there ahead of you is, and they get to have their scene again
goblin bartender
and they would
raising
get,
a glass
and they wouldn't get that lovely little exclamation point on the end of this of the story if you didn't kill him. So you kind of have to, right? That's what I'm getting at, is you kind of have to kill the
right now and again
if you want to have that cathartic moment.
There's an interesting kind of cutscene that I do all the time, but it's a player cutscene, which is the post game summary of what happens to your character after the adventures are over. Yep. And I think that is a super powerful tool in the GM toolbox, so that people can sort of do a coda for their character,
Yeah, I do that every single game I run, especially my one-shots I do at conventions where they might not have tied up all the loose ends. I didn't even think about that as being a cutscene, but it is. We're not touching the mechanics at all. Nope. It's you and me.
You can do player oriented cutscenes in the middle, do flashbacks too in the middle of the game. You can be like, the character mentions something about, when their parents died, because every character comes from, has dead parents, right? So like you can have them, jump back to the morning. Not an MOURN, right? Like their character mourning the passing and do a little flashback. Or if you're doing a heist story, you almost have to do the flashback cutscenes of like, well, now you magically, magically got out of this situation. And now we cut back to how you knew and you prepared for. And it's like, okay, now all of you give me a cutscene of like how you planned to do this thing that you can now enact.
Because
we skipped that before.
I'm glad that you talked about heists very briefly. I just watched Logan Lucky. My husband made me watch it. after me insisting that I've seen it before. No, I hadn't. I'd seen Lucky Number 11, which is a different movie. But we watched it, and there's actually not a lot of flashbacks in this heist movie. There's just one. And I think that using the one flashback they gave was so incredibly effective. And I don't want to spoil it if anyone's not seen it, because it was a really good movie. It was very entertaining. Adam Driver is in it, and he's great. And Channing Tatum, and he's awesome.
Nice.
Sorry, I just had to, I had to had to talk about the heist and the flashback of the cutscenes. Do we have
Yeah,
any
like
final
Blades
thoughts?
in the
Oh,
Dark has that heist cutscene mechanic. So, yeah.
yeah, building them in. I mean, that's not even our, it's not really our game design topic, either, but
No, it's not,
we could talk
but
about that all the time.
games do that. Yeah.
Right. Do we have final thoughts before we do move on to that game design topic for today?
You got to kill your NPC. I've said it before, you
Yeah,
know, you got
right.
to do it. You can't have the great moments afterwards if you don't kill the important NPC, the beloved goblin bartender. What's his name?
Blorbo must die.
Blorbo.
Glorbo must die.
Blorbo Must Die is the name of my new TTRPG.
Oh, it's a one-shot RPG, and every time Blorbo has to die, and so that you can have a cathartic moment at the end.
Hold on, let me write
Nice.
this down.
I want to play that game.
That's a fun little zine to write later. So for our game design topic, a little bit of a switch is about writing examples of play as a designer. And this is a tough one.
Yeah. They're basically the cutscenes in the rules texts.
Yeah, they are.
Yeah.
You're
They
not
are.
wrong.
I paired these together for a reason. I very much
Right,
consider
yeah.
examples of play to be the cutscenes. They're the points where, like, oh, now you know how the mechanic. Okay, we're going to describe the mechanics. We're going to do this. Da, 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 and now we're going to like play out a little scene,
Yeah.
short, long, whatever it is, where we did, where we show kind of how the game plays in some respect.
Yeah, and I designed a game called Mortal Coil a long time ago that some people had trouble playing as the rules as written. And when I revised it, I added in extended play examples. And that was what was needed to get people to figure it out. It was like, here's this kind of conflict, and the whole description of an example of play, each of the characters doing their actions and the GM's reactions and everything. And over the definitely like four or five different ways you could do a conflict in that game. So the chapter is quite long. And I think that is, it was an error on my part not to have included it in the first edition. So,
Yeah, I mean, it's not like in a game like that, it's not like you didn't explain the rules. And there are going to be some people who are reading your book. We haven't really explained what an example of play is, but
Oh,
that
sure.
we kind of did, but not fully. So let me practice what I preach and give an example of play. So you explain your rules in the text, you do your mechanics writing and your mechanical writing. And then you have a space where you're imagining, you're writing at like what is actually happening at the table. And some people do it in different ways. I've seen people give character names and then like just narrate it out. I've seen people do examples of play that were like flowcharty as well. But I've mostly seen like the narrative examples. But it's not necessarily wrong to not have the example of play, but you are going to lose people who struggle to learn a rule from just the mechanical text, just the text on the mechanics. So if you have ever been trying to read a board game rule book and you're like, I just don't get it, and then you play the game and it clicks. like that the people who have to play the game to understand the mechanic, that's really who those examples of play are for, because like seeing them in action is different than like reading about it in your head. We did a lot of examples of play in the Means of Magic because, in my opinion, the rules for that are very complicated. And there's a lot to kind of like when you're writing it on the page, it seems like a lot, but when you actually do it, it's not as complicated. And for me, as a person who has a hard time reading a bunch of words on a page, technical words, I was thinking about technical, not mechanical, technical writing, whatever, doesn't matter. I'm interrupting myself. I have a hard time like reading like rule sets, just like visually, or hearing rule sets and then having it click. I have to like get my hands on it, or I need to be given a specific example of how it's used. Otherwise, it's just like in one ear, not the other. It does not work for me. And I know I'm not alone in that.
Yeah,
Yeah.
there's a Japanese RPG tradition called the replay, which is like a script almost of people playing the game. And generally it's based on an actual play example, where they basically script out like a screenplay with each player's words and their actions and the roles and everything, where they go through a whole adventure or scenario with it. Sometimes it'll get published independently. It's like an early kind of AP method of entertainment, and that I think is a pretty interesting way to handle it too, rather than just sort of a block of text.
And it can be very long and it can be very short. Like I've
Yeah.
seen games where you early in the game, before you really even get too deep into the rules, you like there's like here's 4 pages in an 8.5 by 11 book of, GM colon says this, describes
Yes.
this, player one named this, says this about their character, does this, rolls this, the GM responds this way. And it's like it's literally kind of reads like a script of just like
Yeah.
the and it's a whole scene. It's a whole like short combat or a scene of like with multiple different types of checks that are taking place. Or it can be like, okay, here's how you resolve a melee attack.
Yeah.
Like here's a little blurb of just like, okay, Jessica, Jess has a character named Blorbo, and Blorbo pulls out his tiny dagger and charges the giant beast.
Oh no, Blarbo,
And here we'll describe how we resolve this attack as Blorbo gets, chopped in half.
no. Right.
Because Blorbo must die.
Blarbo must die.
Yeah, I in the Means of Magic, we did both. We did like little narrative chunks of text, like reading like as if you're reading like a short story, some prose. We did the script style as well. We did longer ones, we did shorter ones. And I mean, again, like if the point of having the examples of play is to be descriptive and to give examples, I think like pick a style and go with it, or vary it as much as you like, not as much as you can, but do a couple varied ones, I think will help capture most of the audience. I like after like when I'm reading a game manual, I like to okay, they present me with a rule or like some rules that work together. Give me a short example. Okay, we present another set of rules. Here's a short example. And then at the end of a chapter, they have a full, like,
Example
here,
of
yeah, everything
here's how a
here's.
combat goes,
Yeah, yeah. And that is super helpful for me. I also really, because Brennan, you said that this replay tradition style is like an actual play or sometimes based off of actual plays. I think that's a great strategy as a game designer is to pull those specific examples from your playtests or from actual plays of your game if you're doing actual plays before you publish the book.
I agree, because I think that's like it's really a where the rules meet reality kind of situation. And so those examples are often better just because they've actually happened. So,
Yeah. I mean, definitely more real. Takes a little bit of the creative writing work off of you as a
It does.
designer.
It does.
Yeah, you can take this recording of whatever scene that you played through, and you're like, oh, this was kind of entertaining, and it described a bunch of different types of checks and things that happened, and it was fun. And so you can just kind of trim out the fat and keep the stuff that kind of keeps it interesting. One thing I was thinking too is that with certain types of games in particular, and maybe with all of them, but certainly with some, you can kind of get the point of the theme and idea behind playing the game beyond like in a what's the play ex what do we kind of expect the play experience to be like? Like if I didn't write any examples of play like this, like a scene long example of play for Die Laughing, but if I had, it would be filled with jokes. You know, it would be filled with like the game is all about like, you know, okay, we're going to have this monster. It's going to come in. It's good. There's going to be something funny that happens as part of it. Cause the whole point of the game is to like, just, you know, make fun of, gently and reverently make fun of horror tropes and embrace horror comedy. And so that would almost be one of those ones I'd want to play the game a few times and record and like actually use snippets of like people making actual jokes of like, you know, even if it was like completely non sequitur stuff, like they're just like busting out a comment, you know, a quote from a movie or something that has nothing to do with the immediate story. Because it gets the point across that like, oh, this is how this game is like, it's perfectly, you don't, as the writer, you don't have to give permission to players to do, to play the game that way because people will play the game they want to play it. But it does reinforce the idea that like, oh, this is encouraged. This is something that you can absolutely do with this game. You know, if you put together a multi-page example of play for a Call of Cthulhu game, I would expect zero jokes. Because the, you know, like that's not that's to say that people don't crack jokes playing Call of Cthulhu, but Call of Cthulhu is maybe one of the least jokey games that's presented because it's really dark and things are going to go very, very badly for your characters at some point. So you would probably have an example of play that focused on just making sure that like you read that by the time you get done reading the example of play, you're like, oh.
But just yeah, basically giving people a good example of how the game feels when it's being played, not just the actual rules being implemented. That's a really good point. I agree. Conveying tone and just sort of giving people an impression of how it should go when they're doing it. So.
I totally agree. I think that's a great opportunity to set tone. I think it's also an opportunity for you to not only narrate or spell out in an example type way of what the players are doing with their moves, with the mechanics, but also the things that they're saying to each other at the table. If there's meta discussion built into your game, especially like what are the players saying to each other? What are the characters saying to each other? Kind of not just setting the tone for like the action inside the game, but like how people discuss things at the table physically, like the people who are there or virtually at the table, or you know, whatever that ends up being. And I would much prefer that be the tone setter than let me admit something, a deep dark secret to you guys. You know, in games where they have like a couple pages of a short story related to the to set the theme, to set the tone and all that, I never read those. I skim through it. I like fiction, but I'm trying to get to the rules and I want to see. I
I
don't read
agree,
those.
and unfortunately, a lot of that fiction's really bad.
So for Jess, every vampire for Jess, every Old World of Darkness game book was actually only half the thickness that it reportedly had.
It's
You
not
skimmed
long.
over it,
We're gonna
and then you're like,
we'll
okay,
skip
I
the
get the
first 20
gist.
pages first.
It's not, I mean, I know this, it's just me and some other people who share my opinion. Some people really like to read those. It helps them get ideas for their games. I have fun with it. And as someone who likes to write fiction, my instinct as a game designer is to write fiction also in my game. But I think it's more of a use of my time as a reader of a manual who wants to pick up the book and play it as soon as possible, is to get to those examples of play rather than the tone setting. Hopefully, I don't need all of the short stories, in order to understand the tone of your game. That should be, in my opinion. Don't come at me with torches and pitchforks, please. I feel like this is a hot take. I don't know. I've said worse on this podcast. I think that that should be extra sprinkles and should not be a support column in your book. That, but examples of play. Oh boy. I mean, introduce your world with the examples of play too.
Yeah, I would like for capers, there's not a big long multi-page example of play in it. But if I were to do one, I would definitely have the players discussing things amongst themselves, because something that happens at the table with capers is people talk about whether or not, like, what's in their discard pile and whether or not their deck has a lot of high cards left in it. And people encourage each other, like, oh, you've got a lot of face cards in your deck, you should keep going. Because that's become a feature of the game, is that there's an engagement by the other players when you're deciding whether or not you're going to flip a card, which is not terribly different from how it is at a craps table when everybody bets with the shooter.
Yes.
But at the same time, the game, you know, the examples of play that are in there are the describing the mechanics, because the playing card mechanics are a little out of the ordinary for a lot of players. So I wanted to make sure, like, okay, here's how a check is going to go. Here's how a combat, you know, or an attack roll is going to go. And so I've included those types of examples of play, the, you know, like just a few paragraphs in a few different games, mostly when, because the mechanics are just a little different than what people might be expecting.
I think you're right, though. I mean, like, the more you vary from the norm of role-playing game rules, the more examples of play you've got to have, because you've really got to instruct people how to do stuff if it's not exactly what they're used to doing in other games. And honestly, if a new player picks up your book, it's useful, even if it's a very traditional style game, to have examples of play in it. So.
Yeah, because every game
Absolutely.
is somebody's first game.
Exactly. Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, also, if you think that you've invented or innovated a new rule, I mean, do everybody a favor and spell it out, because your rule might be super, super cool. And then you read it on paper like that, and it doesn't seem as cool as when you actually spell it out within the example of play. And I think that that also is a way to highlight, like, what makes a like an okay rule set versus a great rule set. Like, for example, if you were applying to the Indie Groundbreaker Awards from the IGDN, what makes something best rules? It's not just like how cool the rules are, you know, and how you explain them, but the people who are reading the book have to, the judges have to like be able to picture it. And the best way to get them to picture it is through those examples of play. I can't speak for the Ennies, but I have my suspicions that the judges on the Ennies also don't go through and play every single game that they are reading through. I
There's no
don't, I,
human way possible that they
no,
do that.
absolutely not. The judges who are reading your rule set for awards, if you wanna try to get some recognition for your really awesome mechanics, you gotta have those examples of play. It's the best way to get people to visualize them.
Especially if the mechanics aren't just like, oh, this is you want to do this thing, you make this check, this determines success or failure and other things that go with it. If there's anything else that bleeds into the mechanics that is like, oh, well, now this, like, and at the end of this check, you're gonna have to check one of these, like with Good Strong Hands for me, which actually got nominated for Best Rules. And I think
Nice.
that probably
Congrats.
there's a couple of things that happened in the rules that, and some of it is in the example of playing, saying, like, you know, if you succeeded on this, now you check this box. If you succeeded on this box, if you failed on this, now you check this box. And that reinforces the idea that there's these tracks of other thing. And there's every trait check that you're making is determining something in the moment, but it's also determining something that's going to play out later, because you're checking check boxes in a track. And that's maybe one of the things that the judges found interesting. And maybe it helped that I mentioned that, like, oh, you're always going to have this thing to do.
Then you spelled it out, basically.
And it does. And if not everyone's going to be great at writing those examples of play too, there are a lot of really great rules writers that are great at the technical writing, and are also great at the more narrative style writing, and are also great at fiction writing. They can do all three. But if you struggle with one or the other, that's where you could get a partner who's writing the game with you. Well, you're really good at writing and coming up with the rules. Okay, this is me and Alex. Alex, you're better at coming up with the rules than I am, but I can explain them actually, whereas you have a hard time doing that. So I will do the writing where I'm explaining them, like in the example of play, and you can spell them out. Or you could hire a freelancer to work with you. Like, okay, here's my mechanics. Could and here here here's what I noticed. Or could you sit on my playtest if maybe if you want to go the extra mile? And can you write some examples of play for me for that? If I those are that's more advanced than I have ever gotten. I don't I've never hired a freelancer to write examples of play for me, but if you have a super huge Kickstarter and you have the money to throw around, maybe that's something you want to do.
Yeah.
I think mentioning playtesting helps too, because just as an aside, one of the questions I ask quite often in playtest is there's two questions: is are the rules clear and intuitive? And then my favorite question about the rules is, was there any part of the rules you had to read twice? Did you have to read three times to understand? And if you get a bunch of people saying, yeah, I had to reread this section multiple times, number one, it probably needs to be clarified in how it's described. Number two, even clarifying it might not help. You might really need an example of play.
All right. And then you gotta be concerned that if somebody had to read through it three times, did they even really understand it after that third time? You know what I mean? So, yeah.
Again, that's like my students, like, okay, did you understand? Yeah, can you explain it back to me?
No.
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 Okay, we need to do this a different way.
Right.
I think too, it is also a great tool for the GM to highlight, like there's a lot of mechanics in games like Dungeons and Dragons that I have never touched as a GM. But if there was a really good example of play that gave me a cool idea of how I could use this thing in my game, I'm more likely to then use that in my game, which is more likely then to highlight all the cool stuff that you obviously spent time as a game designer writing that you thought was important enough to put in your game. I don't know. I think everyone should have examples of play. Yeah, I'm thinking about like all the games that I've done recently. I gotta say, did not do it as much with Moonpunk as I should have done with Moonpunk, but it was also a Powered by the Apocalypse game. Pretty straightforward, and I feel like a lot of the playbooks kind of explain, but I should have still done it. I think it would have it could still help people maybe in a future edition of Moonpunk, but everything else I've done has been riddled with them.
Yeah, Moonpunk was your first game too, right?
It was my first published game, yeah.
So not surprising that you didn't do as much on that one as you later came to decide was important. So yeah,
You learn, you live,
you
you
learn.
learn.
Well, you find you as a designer, you find your way to convey that information. And some people find that they're very good, and this may very well be true. Some people will are incredibly good at describing, just doing the technical stuff, describing the
Absolutely.
rules, making it crystal clear. So even people who get confused or a little bit thrown by some of that stuff are going to come out of it going, oh yeah, okay, I got this. I got this under control. And then some people, maybe you don't feel you're as confident in developing that particular skill, or you're not at that point yet. And or you maybe even recognize I'm probably never going to be at that point yet. So then, give yourself the permission to be like, okay, I need to provide this additional information.
Absolutely. It also came to, it's not just like the experience of game designing, but it's not that I didn't read a lot of books and play a lot of games before I did Moonpunk, but I've read since from the time when I first like was getting into the gaming industry back in like 2015 when I was doing freelance like adventure writing, which is all basically a huge example of play, when I was writing adventures, to Moonpunk. Then Moonpunk on, I like have just exploded in my amount that I've engaged with games of all sorts of all different genres, read a lot, talked with a lot of people, and figured out what they were doing with their rules mechanics. And I've been able to like, with more experience, you and more experience as a player and more experience as a like as a reader, I've just like, you know, you pick up some of those skills, which is another reason why it's important to, if you really want to get into game design, I think it's important to engage with the work of your peers and the work of even people who aren't your peer, like peers in genre, peers in level, peers in types of games, but also the wider range of indie games. Learn from other people and steal their ideas and make them yours and then put them in your game is what I'm saying.
Nice. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
That's, I mean, so many of my good ideas have come out of this podcast, in fact, and our guests. I'm like a vampire. I'm draining draining
training
your
ideas from your
yes.
guests, leaving them with no ideas.
Yes. Oh yeah, we really like going on RPG R&D, but oh my gosh, after we're done, we're like so tired. And I just don't have
I
any.
always have to take a nap. You know, I've realized that I never sit down and do any design work after I talk to Jess.
And she looks so full of life afterwards.
I always just go watch 8 episodes of How I Met Your Mother, which I've seen before.
Oh man. Do we have any other final thoughts on our examples of play before we start wrapping up this sode?
I think you summed it up pretty well. Just do it. So,
Yeah.
just a note, I think too, that can be thrown out there, because I know people love their APs. There are APs out there. You can put the example of play in a video too. I mean, not to
Yes.
say that you don't put it in the book, but you can even, like, you know, if you know you're going to have a website and that website name's not going to change, and you can actually put the path in the book and all that sort of thing, or you can just say, go to our website to see, you know, some of these things played out a little bit too. And you could go and record and just, like, you know, here's me with two players doing a short little scene, and each of the two players has to make a couple of checks. And you sit down with the players and you say, okay, well, you prep them beforehand and be like, okay, this is what it's going to be about. We're going to make sure each of you needs to make these types of checks, and we're going to play them out. And do a 5-minute video that, like, describes, like, oh, here's, like, everything you need to know about running a combat in 5 minutes. Like, that's easy to absorb. That's something that people will, who maybe don't want to read 4 pages of description, will sit and watch.
I
Th
know
those
for a
those
fact,
four pages of description actually played out
not
with emotion.
I haven't been a judge for the Groundbreakers. However, I have been the facilitator for judges and helped them
Me too.
get to the rules that they've needed. I know for a fact that videos have helped judges make decisions about games.
Yeah.
Yep, absolutely. I know, I can name games
Me too.
that have
Yeah.
won.
Saltfish and Almanacs. That was a huge one. Yeah.
Character creation for Good Society.
And I think, again, the more different your game is, the more you want to have, the more different kinds of examples you want to have out there, because people learn all in different ways. So having videos, having text, having all kinds of stuff is good.
I hold on 1 second. Oh my gosh. So, Craig, you and I gave examples of games from the same game company, and it was their videos. So go Story Brewers.
Nice.
Go watch their videos and see how they explain their rules, because that is
They know what they're
absolutely
doing,
apparent.
apparently.
Yeah, Good Society and Saltfish and Almanacs. I know their videos are really good. And I love
Nice.
their games. Their games are also really great. Yeah, Brendan, thanks for coming on the show
Happy to
again.
join you. Yep.
Where can we find you? What are you doing now, and where can we find it?
I'm working on games still. I'm currently working on a game in development that I'm calling, its working title is Teenage Ninja Fighting School, which is a shonen game. So that one is in development. I'll be play testing it at Metatopia this year. And you can find me online at Brennan R. Taylor on the socials. So
That I the name will get me
yeah,
instantly. I'm like, okay, yeah. You can find me on the internet at Joska or sometimes at Jess is Awful, and you have to figure that out. That's all part of the game.
I
And wannabegames.com.
And I am at Nerdburger Craig pretty much everywhere. Nerdburger Games is the website. Right now, you can go to Kickstarter for Capers Expanded, the absolute final. This is it, putting the exclamation point on the end of the Capers game line. This is a core game supplement. It's like if we had had a bigger Kickstarter back in the day when Capers came out, like this is the type of stuff that would have gone in there. It's like more setting, more powers, more all sorts of everything. Basically, every other great idea I had for Capers stuff is getting just barfed out into a supplement book.
Nice.
So it's a, you know, new people will be able to discover the game, but it is very much a love letter to the longtime fans of like, here's one more go around for some all sorts of cool stuff for Capers as we wrap up the game line. So check that first before you go looking at DriveThruRPG or NerdburgerGames.com.
It's almost like you have a big anniversary for that game coming up. No comment. No comment on your
No, I mean,
on your big anniversary.
Capers came out in 2018, so it's 6 years the game's been around.
Oh no, it's your anniversary for Nerdburger Games.
Nerdburger Games will be 10 years old in 2 years. So,
Nice.
and yeah, I
Congratulations.
actually have a list of things that I'm starting to think about, like what that's going to
For
look
the
like
anniversary,
for the
yeah.
anniversary year, what I'm hoping to have done and ready for then, including a new game line, and doing some cool stuff at Gen Con and all sorts of stuff.
Very nice.
Cool. Thank you to our opening and closing theme song, which is Outfield by Steph Sax, licensed under Creative Commons. Thank you so much, Steph Sax, and thanks all of you for listening. And we'll see you back here next time. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.